"You shall have tea before you go home," he added. "I am by myself. Hareton is gone with some cattle to the Lees, and Zillah and Joseph are off on a journey of pleasure. And though I'm used to being alone, I'd rather have some interesting company if I can get it. Miss Linton, take your seat by him. I give you what I have. The present is hardly worth accepting, but I have nothing else to offer. It is Linton, I mean." How she does stare. It's odd what a savage feeling I have to anything that seems afraid of me. Had I been born where laws are less strict and tastes less dainty, I should treat myself to a slow vivisection of those two as an evening's amusement. He drew in his breath, struck the table, and swore to himself, "By hell, I hate them."
"I'm not afraid of you," exclaimed Catherine, who could not hear the latter part of his speech.
She stepped close up, her black eyes flashing with passion and resolution.
"Give me that key. I will have it," she said. "I wouldn't eat or drink here if I were starving."
Heathcliff had the key in his hand that remained on the table. He looked up, seized with a sort of surprise at her boldness, or possibly reminded by her voice and glance of the person from whom she inherited it. She snatched at the instrument, and half succeeded in getting it out of his loosened fingers. But her action recalled him to the present. He recovered it speedily. "Now, Catherine Linton," he said, "stand off, or I shall knock you down, and that will make Mrs. Dean mad." Regardless of this warning, she captured his closed hand and its contents again.
"We will go,"
she repeated, exerting her utmost efforts to cause the iron muscles to relax, and finding that her nails made no impression, she applied her teeth pretty sharply. Heathcliff glanced at me, a glance that kept me from interfering a moment. Catherine was too intent on his fingers to notice his face. He opened them suddenly and resigned the object of dispute. But ere she had well secured it, he seized her with the liberated hand and, pulling her on his knee, administered with the other a shower of terrific slaps on both sides of the head, each sufficient to have fulfilled his threat had she been able to fall. At this diabolical violence, I rushed on him furiously. "You villain!" I began to cry. "You villain!" A touch on the chest silenced me. I am stout, and soon put out of breath, and what with that and the rage, I staggered dizzily back and felt ready to suffocate, or to burst a blood vessel. The scene was over in 2 minutes. Catherine, released, put her two hands to her temples, and looked just as if she were not sure whether her ears were off or on. She trembled like a reed, poor thing, and leant against the table, perfectly bewildered.
"I know how to chastise children, you see," said the scoundrel, grimly, as he stooped to repossess himself of the key which had dropped to the floor. "Go to Linton now, as I told you, and cry at your ease. I shall be your father tomorrow, all the father you'll have in a few days, and you shall have plenty of that. You can bear plenty, you're no weakling. You shall have a daily taste if I catch such a devil of a temper in your eyes again."
Cathy ran to me instead of Linton, and knelt down and put her burning cheek on my lap, weeping aloud. Her cousin had shrunk into a corner of the settle, as quiet as a mouse, congratulating himself, I dare say, that the correction had alighted on another than him. Mr. Heathcliff, perceiving us all confounded, rose and expeditiously made the tea himself. The cups and saucers were laid ready. He poured it out and handed me a cup.
"Wash away your spleen," he said, "and help your own naughty pet and mine. It is not poisoned, though I prepared it. I'm going out to seek your horses."
Our first thought on his departure was to force an exit somewhere. We tried the kitchen door, but that was fastened outside. We looked at the windows. They were too narrow for even Cathy's little figure.
"Master Linton,"
I cried, seeing we were regularly imprisoned. You know what your diabolical father is after, and you shall tell us, or I'll box your ears as he has done your cousins. Yes, Linton, you must tell, said Catherine. It was for your sake I came, and it will be wickedly ungrateful if you refuse.
Give me some tea. I'm thirsty, and then I'll tell you, he answered. Mrs. Dean, go away. I don't like you standing over me. Now, Catherine, you are letting your tears fall into my cup. I won't drink that. Give me another.
Catherine pushed another to him and wiped her face. I felt disgusted at the little wretch's composure, since he was no longer in terror for himself. The anguish he had exhibited on the moor subsided as soon as ever he entered Wuthering Heights, so I guessed he had been menaced with an awful visitation of wrath if he failed in decoying us there, and, that accomplished, he had no further immediate fears.
"Papa wants us to be married," he continued after sipping some of the liquid. "And he knows your papa wouldn't let us marry now, and he's afraid of my dying if we wait. So we are to be married in the morning, and you are to stay here all night. And if you do as he wishes, you shall return home next day and take me with you."
"Take you with her? Pitiful changeling," I exclaimed. "You marry? Why, the man is mad, or he thinks us fools, every one. And do you imagine that beautiful young lady, that healthy, hearty girl, will tie herself to a little perishing monkey like you? Are you cherishing the notion that anybody, let alone Miss Catherine Linton, would have you for a husband? You want whipping for bringing us in here at all, with your dastardly puling tricks. And don't look so silly now. I've a very good mind to shake you severely for your contemptible treachery and your imbecile conceit." I did give him a slight shaking, but it brought on the cough, and he took to his ordinary resource of moaning and weeping, and Catherine rebuked me. "Stay all night?" "No," she said, looking slowly round. "Ellen, I'll burn that door down, but I'll get out." And she would have commenced the execution of her threat directly, but Linton was up in alarm for his dear self again. He clasped her in his two feeble arms, sobbing.
"Won't you have me and save me? Not let me come to the Grange. Oh, darling Catherine, you mustn't go and leave. After all, you must obey my father, you must."
"I must obey my own," she replied, "and relieve him from this cruel suspense. The whole night? What would he think? He'll be distressed already. I'll either break or burn a way out of the house. Oh, be quiet. You're in no danger. But if you hinder me, Linton, I love Papa better than you." The mortal terror he felt of Mr. Heathcliff's anger restored to the boy his coward's eloquence. Catherine was near distraught. Still, she persisted that she must go home, and tried entreaty in her turn, persuading him to subdue his selfish agony. While they were thus occupied, our jailer re-entered.
"Your beasts have trotted off," he said. "And now Linton snivelling again. What has she been doing to you? Come, come, have done, and get to bed. In a month or two, my lad, you'll be able to pay her back her present tyrannies with a vigorous hand. You're pining for pure love, are you not? Nothing else in the world, and she shall have you. There, to bed. Zillah won't be here tonight. You must undress yourself. Hush! Hold your noise. Once in your own room, I'll not come near you. You needn't fear. By chance, you've managed tolerably. I'll look to the rest."
He spoke these words, holding the door open for his son to pass, and the latter achieved his exit exactly as a spaniel might, which suspected the person who attended on it of designing a spiteful squeeze. The lock was re-secured. Heathcliff approached the fire, where my mistress and I stood silent. Catherine looked up, and instinctively raised her hand to her cheek. His neighbourhood revived a painful sensation. Anybody else would have been incapable of regarding the childish act with sternness, but he scowled on her and muttered,
"Oh, you are not afraid of me. your courage is well disguised. You seem damnably afraid.
I am afraid now, she replied. Because if I stay, Papa will be miserable. And how can I endure making him miserable when he... Mr. Heathcliff, let me go home. I promised to marry Linton. Papa would like me to, and I love him. Why should you wish to force me to do what I'll willingly do of myself?
Let him dare to force you, I cried. There's law in the land, thank God. There is, though we be in an out-of-the-way place. I'd inform if he were my own son, and it's felony without benefit of clergy. Silence, said the ruffian. To the devil with your clamour. I don't want you to speak. Miss Linton, I shall enjoy myself remarkably in thinking your father will be miserable. I shall not sleep for satisfaction. You could have hit on no surer way of fixing your residence under my roof for the next 24 hours than informing me that such an event would follow. As to your promise to marry Linton, I'll take care you shall keep it, for you shall not quit this place till it is fulfilled.
"Send Ellen, then, to let Papa know I'm safe," exclaimed Catherine, weeping bitterly. "Or marry me now. Poor Papa, Ellen, he'll think we're lost. What shall we do?"
"Not he. He'll think you are tired of waiting on him and run off for a little amusement," answered Heathcliff. "You cannot deny that you entered my house of your own accord, in contempt of his injunctions to the contrary. And it is quite natural that you should desire amusement at your age, and that you would weary of nursing a sick man, and that man only your father. Catherine, his happiest days were over when your days began. He cursed you, I dare say, for coming into the world. I did, at least. And it would just do if he cursed you as he went out of it. I'd join him. I don't love you. How should I? Weep away. As far as I can see, it will be your chief diversion hereafter, unless Linton make amends for other losses, and your provident parent appears to fancy he may. His letters of advice and consolation entertained me vastly. In his last he recommended my jewel to be careful of his, and kind to her when he got her. Careful and kind, that's paternal. But Linton requires his whole stock of care and kindness for himself. Linton can play the little tyrant well. He'll undertake to torture any number of cats, if their teeth be drawn and their claws pared. You'll be able to tell his uncle fine tales of his kindness when you get home again, I assure you.
You're right there, I said. Explain your son's character. Show his resemblance to yourself. And then I hope Miss Cathy will think twice before she takes the cockatrice.
I don't much mind speaking of his amiable qualities now, he answered, because she must either accept him or remain a prisoner, and you along with her, till your master dies. I can detain you both quite concealed here. If you doubt, encourage her to retract her word, and you'll have an opportunity of judging.
I'll not retract my word, said Catherine. I'll marry him within this hour, if I may go to Thrushcross Grange afterwards. Mr. Heathcliff, you're a cruel man, but you're not a fiend, and you won't, from mere malice, destroy irrevocably all my happiness. If Papa thought I had left him on purpose, and if he died before I returned, could I bear to live? I've given over crying, but I'm going to kneel here at your knee, and I'll not get up, and I'll not take my eyes from your face till you look back at me. No, don't turn away. Do look. You'll see nothing to provoke you. I don't hate you. I'm not angry that you struck me. Have you never loved anybody in all your life, Uncle? Never? Ah, you must look once. I'm so wretched. You can't help being sorry and pitying me.
Keep your eft's fingers off, and move, or I'll kick you,
cried Heathcliff, brutally repulsing her.
I'd rather be hugged by a snake. How the devil can you dream of fawning on me? I detest you.
He shrugged his shoulders, shook himself, indeed, as if his flesh crept with aversion, and thrust back his chair, while I got up and opened my mouth to commence a downright torrent of abuse. But I was rendered dumb in the middle of the first sentence by a threat that I should be shown into a room by myself the very next syllable I uttered. It was growing dark. We heard a sound of voices at the garden gate. Our host hurried out instantly. He had his wits about him, we had not. There was a talk of 2 or 3 minutes, and he returned, alone. "I thought it had been your cousin Hareton," I observed to Catherine. "I wish he would arrive. Who knows but he might take our part."
"It was 3 servants sent to seek you from the Grange," said Heathcliff, overhearing me. "You should have opened a lattice and called out. But I could swear that chit is glad you didn't. She's glad to be obliged to stay, I'm certain."
At learning the chance we had missed, we both gave vent to our grief without control, and he allowed us to wail on till 9 o'clock. Then he bid us go upstairs, through the kitchen, to Zillah's chamber, and I whispered my companion to obey. Perhaps we might contrive to get through the window there, or into a garret and out by its skylight. The window, however, was narrow, like those below, and the garret trap was safe from our attempts, for we were fastened in as before. We neither of us lay down. Catherine took her station by the lattice and watched anxiously for morning, a deep sigh being the only answer I could obtain to my frequent entreaties that she would try to rest. I seated myself in a chair and rocked to and fro, passing harsh judgment on my many derelictions of duty, from which it struck me then all the misfortunes of my employers sprang. It was not the case in reality, I am aware, but it was in my imagination that dismal night, and I thought Heathcliff himself less guilty than I. At 7 o'clock he came and inquired if Miss Linton had risen. She ran to the door immediately and answered, "Yes."
"Here, then,"
he said, opening it and pulling her out. I rose to follow, but he turned the lock again. I demanded my release.
"Be patient," he replied. "I'll send up your breakfast in a while."
I thumped on the panels and rattled the latch angrily, and Catherine asked why I was still shut up. He answered, "I must try to endure it another hour," and they went away. I endured it 2 or 3 hours. At length, I heard a footstep, not Heathcliff's.
"I've brought you something to eat," said a voice. "Up and do her."
Complying eagerly, I beheld Hareton, laden with food enough to last me all day.
"Take it,"
he added, thrusting the tray into my hand.
"Stay 1 minute," I began.
"Nay,"
cried he, and retired, regardless of any prayers I could pour forth to detain him. And there I remained, enclosed the whole day, and the whole of the next night, and another. 5 nights and 4 days I remained, altogether, seeing nobody but Hareton once every morning, and he was a model of a jailer, surly and dumb, and deaf to every attempt at moving his sense of justice or compassion.
Chapter 28.
On the 5th morning, or rather afternoon, a different step approached, lighter and shorter, and this time the person entered the room. It was Zillah, donned in a scarlet shawl, with a black silk bonnet on her head, and a willow basket swung to her arm.
"Ay, dear Mrs. Dean," she exclaimed. "Well, there is talk about you at Gimmerton. I never thought but you were sunk in the Black Horse Marsh, and Missy with you, till Master told me you'd been found and he'd lodged to hear. What, and you must have got on an island, sure. And how long were you in the hole, did Master save you, Mrs. Dean? But you're not so thin, you've not been so poorly, have you?"
"Your master is a true scoundrel," I replied, "but he shall answer for it. He needn't have raised that tale. It shall all be laid bare."
"What do you mean?"
asked Zilla. "It's not his tale. They tell that in the village. About you being lost in the marsh. And I calls to Earnshaw when I come in. Hey, there's queer things, Mr. Ayrton, happened since I went off. It's a sad pity of that likely young lass and Cant Nelly Dean." He stared. I thought he had not heard aught, so I told him the rumour. The master listened and he just smiled to himself and said, "If they had been in the marsh, they're out now. Zilla Nelly Dean is lodged at this minute in your room. You can tell her to flip when you go up. Here's the key." The bog water got round her head and she would have run home quite flighty, but I fixed her till she came round to her senses. You can bid her go to the Grange at once if she be able and carry a message from me that a young lady will follow in time to attend the squire's funeral. "Oh, Mr. Edgar is not dead," I gasped. "Oh, Zilla, Zilla!" "No, no, sit you down, my good mistress," she replied. "You're right sickly yet. He's not dead. Dr. Kenneth thinks he may last another day. I met him on the road and asked." Instead of sitting down, I snatched my outdoor things and hastened below, for the way was free. On entering the house, I looked about for someone to give information of Catherine. The place was filled with sunshine, and the door stood wide open, but nobody seemed at hand. As I hesitated whether to go off at once or return and seek my mistress, a slight cough drew my attention to the hearth. Linton lay on the settle, sole tenant, sucking a stick of sugar candy and pursuing my movements with apathetic eyes. "Where is Miss Catherine?" I demanded sternly, supposing I could frighten him into giving intelligence by catching him thus alone. He sucked on like an innocent. "Is she gone?" I said.
"No," he replied. "She's upstairs. She's not to go. We won't let her."
"You won't let her, little idiot," I exclaimed. "Direct me to her room immediately, or I shall make you sing out sharply."
"Papa would make you sing out if you attempted to get there," he answered. "He says I'm not to be soft with Catherine. She's my wife, and it's shameful that she should wish to leave me. He says she hates me and wants me to die, that she may have my money. But she shan't have it, and she shan't go home. She never shall. She may cry and be as sick as much as she pleases."
He resumed his former occupation, closing his lids as if he meant to drop asleep. "Master Heathcliff," I resumed, "have you forgotten all Catherine's kindness to you last winter, when you affirmed you loved her, and when she brought you books, and sung you songs, and came many a time through wind and snow to see you? She wept to miss one evening because you would be disappointed, and you felt then that she was 100 times too good to you, and now you believe the lies your father tells, though you know he detests you both. And you join him against her. That's fine gratitude, is it not?" The corner of Linton's mouth fell, and he took the sugar candy from his lips. "Did she come to Wuthering Heights because she hated you?" I continued. "Think for yourself. As to your money, she does not even know that you have any. And you say she's sick, and yet you leave her alone up there in a strange house. You, who have felt what it is to be so neglected, you could pity your own sufferings, and she pitied them too, but you won't pity hers. I shed tears, Master Heathcliff, you see. An elderly woman and a servant merely. And you, after pretending such affection, and having reason to worship her almost, store every tear you have for yourself, and lie there quite at ease. Oh, you're a heartless, selfish boy."
"I can't stay with her," he answered crossly. "I'll not stay by myself. She cries so that I can't bear it. And she won't give over, though I say I'll call my father. I did call him once, and he threatened to strangle her if she was not quiet, but she began again the instant he left the room, moaning and grieving all night long, though I screamed for vexation that I couldn't sleep."
"Is Mr. Heathcliff out?" I inquired, perceiving that the wretched creature had no power to sympathise with his cousin's mental tortures.
"He's in the court," he replied, "talking to Dr. Kenneth, who says Uncle is dying truly at last. I'm glad, for I shall be master of the Grange after him. Catherine always spoke of it as her house. It isn't hers, it's mine. Papa says everything she has is mine. All her nice books are mine. She offered to give me them, and her pretty birds, and her pony Minnie, if I would get the key of our room and let her out. But I told her she had nothing to give. They were all mine. And then she cried, and took a little picture from her neck, and said I should have that. Two pictures in a gold case, on one side her mother, and on the other her uncle, when they were young. That was yesterday. I said they were mine, too, and tried to get them from her. The spiteful thing wouldn't let me. She pushed me off and hurt me. I shrieked out. That frightens her. She heard Papa coming, and she broke the hinges and divided the case and gave me her mother's portrait. The other she attempted to hide. But Papa asked what was the matter, and I explained it. He took the one I had away and ordered her to resign hers to me. She refused, and he struck her down and wrenched it off the chain and crushed it with his foot.
"And were you pleased to see her struck?" I asked, having my designs in encouraging his talk.
"I winked," he answered. "I wink to see my father strike a dog or a horse. He does it so hard. Yet I was glad at first. She deserved punishing for pushing me. But when Papa was gone, she made me come to the window and showed me her cheek cut on the inside against her teeth and her mouth filling with blood. And then she gathered up the bits of the picture and went and sat down with her face to the wall, and she has never spoken to me since, and I sometimes think she can't speak for pain. I don't like to think so, but she's a naughty thing for crying continually, and she looks so pale and wild. I'm afraid of her."
"And you can get the key if you choose," I said.
"Yes, when I am upstairs," he answered. "But I can't walk upstairs now."
"In what apartment is it?" I asked.
"Oh," he cried, "I shan't tell you where it is. It's our secret. Nobody, neither Hareton nor Zillah, is to know. There. You've tired me. Go away, go away."
And he turned his face onto his arm and shut his eyes again. I considered it best to depart without seeing Mr. Heathcliff, and to bring a rescue for my young lady from the Grange. On reaching it, the astonishment of my fellow servants to see me, and their joy also, was intense. And when they heard that their little mistress was safe, two or three were about to hurry up and shout the news at Mr. Edgar's door. But I bespoke the announcement of it myself. How changed I found him, even in those few days. He lay an image of sadness and resignation, awaiting his death. Very young he looked, though his actual age was 39. One would have called him 10 years younger, at least. He thought of Catherine, for he murmured her name. I touched his hand and spoke. "Catherine is coming, dear master," I whispered. "She is alive and well and will be here, I hope, tonight." I trembled at the first effects of this intelligence. He half rose up, looked eagerly round the apartment, and then sank back in a swoon. As soon as he recovered, I related our compulsory visit and detention at the Heights. I said Heathcliff forced me to go in, which was not quite true. I uttered as little as possible against Linton, nor did I describe all his father's brutal conduct, my intentions being to add no bitterness, if I could help it, to his already overflowing cup. He divined that one of his enemy's purposes was to secure the personal property, as well as the estate, to his son, or rather himself. Yet why he did not wait till his decease was a puzzle to my master, because ignorant how nearly he and his nephew would quit the world together. However, he felt that his will had better be altered. Instead of leaving Catherine's fortune at her own disposal, he determined to put it in the hands of trustees for her use during life, and for her children, if she had any, after her. By that means, it could not fall to Mr. Heathcliff should Linton die. Having received his orders, I dispatched a man to fetch the attorney, and four more provided with serviceable weapons to demand my young lady of her jailer. Both parties were delayed very late. The single servant returned first. He said Mr. Green, the lawyer, was out when he arrived at his house, and he had to wait 2 hours for his re-entrance. And then Mr. Green told him he had a little business in the village that must be done, but he would be at Thrushcross Grange before morning. The four men came back unaccompanied also. They brought word that Catherine was ill, too ill to quit her room, and Heathcliff would not suffer them to see her. I scolded the stupid fellows well for listening to that tale, which I would not carry to my master, resolving to take a whole bevy up to the heights at daylight and storm it literally unless the prisoner were quietly surrendered to us. Her father shall see her, I vowed and vowed again, if that devil be killed on his own doorstones in trying to prevent it. Happily I was spared the journey and the trouble. I had gone downstairs at 3 o'clock to fetch a jug of water, and was passing through the hall with it in my hand, when a sharp knock at the front door made me jump. "Oh, it is Green," I said, recollecting myself. "Only Green." And I went on, intending to send somebody else to open it. But the knock was repeated, not loud, and still importunately. I put the jug on the banister, and hastened to admit him myself. The harvest moon shone clear outside. It was not the attorney. My own sweet little mistress sprang on my neck, sobbing, "Ellen, Ellen, is Papa alive?" "Yes," I cried. "Yes, my angel, he is. Oh, God be thanked, you are safe with us again." She wanted to run, breathless as she was, upstairs to Mr. Linton's room. But I compelled her to sit down on a chair and made her drink and washed her pale face, chafing it into a faint colour with my apron. Then I said I must go first and tell of her arrival, imploring her to say she should be happy with young Heathcliff. She stared, but soon comprehending why I counselled her to utter the falsehood, she assured me she would not complain. I couldn't abide to be present at their meeting. I stood outside the chamber door a quarter of an hour, and hardly ventured near the bed then. All was composed, however. Catherine's despair was as silent as her father's joy. She supported him calmly, in appearance, and he fixed on her features his raised eyes that seemed dilating with ecstasy. "He died blissfully, Mr. Lockwood. He died so." Kissing her cheek, he murmured, "I am going to her, and you, darling child, shall come to us." And never stirred or spoke again, but continued that rapt, radiant gaze, till his pulse imperceptibly stopped and his soul departed. None could have noticed the exact minute of his death, it was so entirely without a struggle. Whether Catherine had spent her tears, or whether the grief were too weighty to let them flow, she sat there, dry-eyed, till the sun rose. She sat till noon, and would still have remained brooding over that deathbed, but I insisted on her coming away, and taking some repose. It was well I succeeded in removing her, for at dinner-time appeared the lawyer, having called at Wuthering Heights to get his instructions how to behave. He had sold himself to Mr. Heathcliff. That was the cause of his delay in obeying my master's summons. Fortunately, no thought of worldly affairs crossed the latter's mind to disturb him after his daughter's arrival. Mr. Green took upon himself to order everything and everybody about the place. He gave all the servants but me notice to quit. He would have carried his delegated authority to the point of insisting that Edgar Linton should not be buried beside his wife, but in the chapel with his family. There was the will, however, to hinder that, and my loud protestations against any infringement of its directions. The funeral was hurried over. Catherine, Mrs. Linton Heathcliff now, was suffered to stay at the Grange till her father's corpse had quitted it. She told me that her anguish had at last spurred Linton to incur the risk of liberating her. She heard the men are sent disputing at the door, and she gathered the sense of Heathcliff's answer. It drove her desperate. Linton, who had been conveyed up to the little parlour soon after I left, was terrified into fetching the key before his father reascended. He had the cunning to unlock and relock the door without shutting it. And when he should have gone to bed, he begged to sleep with Hareton, and his petition was granted for once. Catherine stole out before break of day. She dared not try the doors, lest the dogs should raise an alarm. She visited the empty chambers and examined their windows, and luckily, lighting on her mother's, she got easily out of its lattice and onto the ground by means of the fir tree close by. Her accomplice suffered for his share in the escape, notwithstanding his timid contrivances.
Chapter 29.
The evening after the funeral, my young lady and I were seated in the library, now musing mournfully, one of us despairingly, on our loss, now venturing conjectures as to the gloomy future. We had just agreed the best destiny which could await Catherine would be a permission to continue resident at the Grange, at least during Linton's life, he being allowed to join her there and I to remain as housekeeper. That seemed rather too favourable an arrangement to be hoped for, and yet I did hope, and began to cheer up under the prospect of retaining my home and my employment, and, above all, my beloved young mistress, when a servant, one of the discarded ones not yet departed, rushed hastily in and said that devil Heathcliff was coming through the court, should he fasten the door in his face. If we had been mad enough to order that proceeding, we had not time. He made no ceremony of knocking or announcing his name. He was master, and availed himself of the master's privilege to walk straight in, without saying a word. The sound of our informant's voice directed him to the library. He entered, and motioning him out, shut the door. It was the same room into which he had been ushered as a guest 18 years before. The same moon shone through the window, and the same autumn landscape lay outside. We had not yet lighted a candle, but all the apartment was visible, even to the portraits on the wall. The splendid head of Mrs. Linton, and the graceful one of her husband. Heathcliff advanced to the hearth. Time had little altered his person either. There was the same man, his dark face rather sallower and more composed, his frame a stone or two heavier, perhaps, and no other difference. Catherine had risen with an impulse to dash out when she saw him.
"Stop," he said, arresting her by the arm. "No more runnings away. Where would you go? I'm come to fetch you home, and I hope you'll be a dutiful daughter, and not encourage my son to further disobedience. I was embarrassed how to punish him when I discovered his part in the business. He's such a cobweb. A pinch would annihilate him. But you'll see by his look that he has received his due. I brought him down one evening, the day before yesterday, and just set him in a chair, and never touched him afterwards. I sent Hareton out, and we had the room to ourselves. In 2 hours, I called Joseph to carry him up again, and since then my presence is as potent on his nerves as a ghost, and I fancy he sees me often, though I am not near. Hareton says he wakes and shrieks in the night by the hour together, and calls you to protect him from me. And whether you like your precious mate or not, you must come. He's your concern now. I yield all my interest in him to you."
"Why not let Catherine continue here?" I pleaded, "and send Master Linton to her. As you hate them both, you'd not miss them. There can only be a daily plague to your unnatural heart."
"I'm seeking a tenant for the Grange," he answered. "And I want my children about me, to be sure. Besides, that lass owes me her services for her bread. I'm not going to nurture her in luxury and idleness after Linton is gone. Make haste and get ready now, and don't oblige me to compel you.
I shall, said Catherine. Linton is all I have to love in the world, and though you have done what you could to make him hateful to me and me to him, you cannot make us hate each other. And I defy you to hurt him when I am by, and I defy you to frighten me.
You are a boastful champion, replied Heathcliff, but I don't like you well enough to hurt him. You shall get the full benefit of the torment, as long as it lasts. It is not I who will make him hateful to you, it is his own sweet spirit. He's as bitter as gall at your desertion and its consequences. Don't expect thanks for this noble devotion. I heard him draw a pleasant picture to Zilla of what he would do if he were as strong as I. The inclination is there, and his very weakness will sharpen his wits to find a substitute for strength.
I know he has a bad nature, said Catherine. He's your son. But I'm glad I've a better to forgive it, and I know he loves me. And for that reason, I love him. Mr. Heathcliff, you have nobody to love you, and however miserable you make us, we shall still have the revenge of thinking that your cruelty arises from your greater misery. You are miserable, are you not? Lonely, like the devil, and envious like him. Nobody loves you. Nobody will cry for you when you die. I wouldn't be you. Catherine spoke with a kind of dreary triumph. She seemed to have made up her mind to enter into the spirit of her future family and draw pleasure from the griefs of her enemies.
You shall be sorry to be yourself presently, said her father-in-law. If you stand there another minute, be gone, witch, and get your things.
She scornfully withdrew. In her absence, I began to beg for Zilla's place at the Heights, offering to resign mine to her, but he would suffer it on no account. He bid me be silent, and then, for the first time, allowed himself a glance round the room and a look at the pictures. Having studied Mrs. Linton's, he said, I shall have that home, not because I need it, but... He turned abruptly to the fire and continued, with what, for lack of a better word, I must call a smile.
I'll tell you what I did yesterday. I got the sexton, who was digging Linton's grave, to remove the earth off her coffin lid, and I opened it. I thought once I would have stayed there. When I saw her face again, it is hers yet. He had hard work to stir me. But he said it would change if the air blew on it, and so I struck one side of the coffin loose and covered it up. Not Linton's side, damn him! I wish he'd been soldered in lead. And I bribed the sexton to pull it away when I'm laid there, and slide mine out too. I'll have it made so. And then, by the time Linton gets to us, he'll not know which is which.
You were very wicked, Mr. Heathcliff, I exclaimed. Were you not ashamed to disturb the dead?
I disturbed nobody, Nelly, he replied, and I gave some ease to myself. I shall be a great deal more comfortable now, and you'll have a better chance of keeping me underground when I get there. Disturbed her? No, she has disturbed me night and day through 18 years. Incessantly, remorselessly, till yesternight. And yesternight I was tranquil. I dreamt I was sleeping the last sleep by that sleeper, with my heart stopped and my cheek frozen against hers.
And if she had been dissolved into earth, or worse, what would you have dreamt of then? I said.
Of dissolving with her and being more happy still, he answered. Do you suppose I dread any change of that sort? I expected such a transformation on raising the lid. But I'm better pleased that it should not commence till I share it. Besides,
unless I had received a distinct impression of her passionless features, that strange feeling would hardly have been removed. It began oddly. You know, I was wild after she died, and eternally from dawn to dawn, praying her to return to me her spirit. I have a strong faith in ghosts. I have a conviction that they can and do exist among us. The day she was buried, there came a fall of snow. In the evening, I went to the churchyard. It blew bleak as winter. All around was solitary. I didn't fear that her fool of a husband would wander up the glen so late, and no one else had business to bring them there. Being alone and conscious, 2 yards of loose earth was the sole barrier between us. I said to myself, I'll have her in my arms again. If she be cold, I'll think it is this north wind that chills me, and if she be motionless, it is sleep. I got a spade from the toolhouse and began to delve with all my might. It scraped the coffin. I fell to work with my hands. The wood commenced cracking about the screws. I was on the point of attaining my object when it seemed that I heard a sigh from someone above, close at the edge of the grave and bending down. If I could only get this off, I muttered, I wish they may shovel in the earth over us both, and I wrenched at it more desperately still. There was another sigh, close at my ear. I appeared to feel the warm breath of it, displacing the sleet-laden wind. I knew no living thing in flesh and blood was by, but as certainly as you perceive the approach to some substantial body in the dark, though it cannot be discerned, so certainly I felt that Cathy was there, not under me, but on the earth. A sudden sense of relief flowed from my heart through every limb. I relinquished my labour of agony and turned, consoled at once, unspeakably consoled. Her presence was with me. It remained while I refilled the grave and led me home. You may laugh if you will, but I was sure I should see her there. I was sure she was with me, and I could not help talking to her. Having reached the heights, I rushed eagerly to the door. It was fastened, and I remember that accursed Earnshaw and my wife opposed my entrance. I remember stopping to kick the breath out of him, and then hurrying upstairs to my room and hers. I looked around impatiently. I felt her by me. I could almost see her, and yet I could not. I ought to have sweat blood then, from the anguish of my yearning, from the fervour of my supplications to have but one glimpse. I had not one. She showed herself, as she often was in life, a devil to me. And since then, sometimes more and sometimes less, I've been the sport of that intolerable torture, infernal, keeping my nerves at such a stretch that if they had not resembled catgut, they would long ago have relaxed to the feebleness of Linton's. When I sat in the house with Hareton, it seemed that on going out I should meet her. When I walked on the moors, I should meet her coming in. When I went from home, I hastened to return. She must be somewhere at the heights, I was certain, and when I slept in her chamber, I was beaten out of that. I couldn't lie there. For the moment I closed my eyes, she was either outside the window, or sliding back the panels, or entering the room, or even resting her darling head on the same pillow as she did when a child. And I must open my lids to see. And so I opened and closed them 100 times a night, to be always disappointed. It racked me. I've often groaned aloud, till that old rascal Joseph no doubt believed that my conscience was playing the fiend inside of me. Now, since I've seen her, I'm pacified a little. It was a strange way of killing, not by inches, but by fractions of hairbreadths, to beguile me with the spectre of a hope through 18 years. Mr. Heathcliff paused and wiped his forehead. His hair clung to it, wet with perspiration. His eyes were fixed on the red embers of the fire, the brows not contracted, but raised next to the temples, diminishing the grim aspect of his countenance, but imparting a peculiar look of trouble and a painful appearance of mental tension towards one absorbing subject. He only half addressed me, and I maintained silence. I didn't like to hear him talk. After a short period, he resumed his meditation on the picture, took it down, and leant it against the sofa to contemplate it at better advantage. And while so occupied, Catherine entered, announcing that she was ready when her pony should be saddled.
"Send that over tomorrow," said Heathcliff to me.
Then turning to her, he added,
"You may do without your pony. It is a fine evening, and you'll need no ponies at Wuthering Heights. For what journeys you take, your own feet will serve you. Come along."
"Goodbye, Ellen," whispered my dear little mistress. As she kissed me, her lips felt like ice. "Come and see me, Ellen. Don't forget."
"Take care you do no such thing, Mrs. Dean," said a new father. "When I wish to speak to you, I'll come here. I want none of your prying at my house."
He signed her to precede him, and casting back a look that cut my heart, she obeyed. I watched them from the window walk down the garden. Heathcliff fixed Catherine's arm under his, though she disputed the act at first, evidently, and with rapid strides he hurried her into the alley, whose trees concealed them.
Chapter 30.
I have paid a visit to the Heights, but I have not seen her since she left. Joseph held the door in his hand when I called to ask after her, and wouldn't let me pass. He said Mrs. Linton was thrang, and the master was not in. Zillah has told me something of the way they go on, otherwise I should hardly know who was dead and who living. She thinks Catherine haughty, and does not like her, I can guess by her talk. My young lady asked some aid of her when she first came, but Mr. Heathcliff told her to follow her own business, and let his daughter-in-law look after herself, and Zillah willingly acquiesced, being a narrow-minded, selfish woman. Catherine evinced a child's annoyance at this neglect, repaid it with contempt, and thus enlisted my informant among her enemies, as securely as if she had done her some great wrong. I had a long talk with Zillah about 6 weeks ago, a little before you came, one day when we foregathered on the moor, and this is what she told me. "The first thing Mrs. Linton did," she said, "on her arrival at the Heights, was to run upstairs without even wishing good evening to me and Joseph. She shut herself into Linton's room and remained till morning. Then, while the master and Earnshaw were at breakfast, she entered the house and asked all in a quiver if the doctor might be sent for. Her cousin was very ill."
"We know that," answered Heathcliff, "but his life is not worth a farthing, and I won't spend a farthing on him."
"But I cannot tell how to do," she said, "and if nobody will help me, he'll die."
"Walk out of the room," cried the master, "and let me never hear a word more about him. None here care what becomes of him. If you do, act the nurse. If you do not, lock him up and leave him."
Then she began to bother me, and I said I'd had enough plague with the tiresome thing. We each had our tasks, and hers was to wait on Linton. Mr. Heathcliff bid me leave that labour to her. How they managed together, I can't tell. I fancy he fretted a great deal and moaned hissel night and day, and she had precious little rest, one would guess by her white face and heavy eyes. She sometimes came into the kitchen all wildered-like, and looked as if she would fain beg assistance, but I was not going to disobey the master. I never dare disobey him, Mrs. Dean. And, though I thought it wrong that Kenneth should not be sent for, it was no concern of mine either to advise or complain, and I always refused to meddle. Once or twice, after we had gone to bed, I've happened to open my door again and seen her sitting crying on the stairs top, and then have shut myself in quick, for fear of being moved to interfere. I did pity her then, I'm sure. Still, I didn't wish to lose my place, you know. At last, one night, she came boldly into my chamber and frightened me out of my wits by saying, "Tell Mr. Heathcliff that his son is dying. I'm sure he is this time. Get up instantly and tell him." Having uttered this speech, she vanished again. I lay a quarter of an hour listening and trembling. Nothing stirred. The house was quiet. "She's mistaken," I said to myself. "He's got over it. I needn't disturb them." And I began to doze. But my sleep was marred a second time by a sharp ringing of the bell, the only bell we have, put up on purpose for Linton. And the master called to me to see what was the matter, and inform them that he wouldn't have that noise repeated. I delivered Catherine's message. He cursed to himself, and in a few minutes came out with a lighted candle and proceeded to their room. I followed. Mrs. Heathcliff was seated by the bedside, with her hands folded on her knees. Her father-in-law went up, held the light to Linton's face, looked at him, and touched him. Afterwards he turned to her.
"Now, Catherine," he said, "how do you feel?"
She was dumb.
"How do you feel, Catherine?"
he repeated.
"He's safe. And I'm free," she answered. "I should feel well, but,"
she continued with a bitterness she couldn't conceal, "you have left me so long to struggle against death alone that I feel and see only death. I feel like death." And she looked like it too. I gave her a little wine. Hareton and Joseph, who had been wakened by the ringing and the sound of feet, and heard our talk from outside, now entered. Joseph was fain, I believe, of the lad's removal. Hareton seemed a thought bothered, though he was more taken up with staring at Catherine than thinking of Linton. But the master bid him get off to bed again. We didn't want his help. He afterwards made Joseph remove the body to his chamber, and told me to return to mine, and Mrs. Heathcliff remained by herself. In the morning, he sent me to tell her she must come down to breakfast. She had undressed and appeared going to sleep and said she was ill, at which I hardly wondered. I informed Mr. Heathcliff, and he replied,
"Well, let her be till after the funeral, and go up now and then to get her what is needful. And as soon as she seems better, tell me."
Cathy stayed upstairs a fortnight, according to Zillah, who visited her twice a day, and would have been rather more friendly, but her attempts at increasing kindness were proudly and promptly repelled. Heathcliff went up once to show her Linton's will. He had bequeathed the whole of his and what had been her movable property to his father. The poor creature was threatened or coaxed into that act during her week's absence, when his uncle died. The lands, being a minor, he could not meddle with. However, Mr. Heathcliff has claimed and kept them in his wife's right, and his also, I suppose legally. At any rate, Catherine, destitute of cash and friends, cannot disturb his possession. "Nobody," said Zillah, "ever approached her door except that once, but I, and nobody asked anything about her. The first occasion of her coming down into the house was on a Sunday afternoon. She had cried out, when I carried up her dinner, that she couldn't bear any longer being in the cold, and I told her the master was going to Thrushcross Grange, and Earnshaw and I needn't hinder her from descending. So, as soon as she heard Heathcliff's horse trot off, she made her appearance, donned in black, and her yellow curls combed back behind her ears as plain as a Quaker. She couldn't comb them out. Joseph and I generally go to chapel on Sundays. The kirk, you know, has no minister now, and they call the Methodists or Baptists' place, I can't say which it is, at Gimmerton, a chapel. Joseph had gone, Zillah continued, but I thought proper to bide at home. Young folks are always the better for an elder's overlooking, and Hareton, with all his bashfulness, isn't a model of nice behaviour. I let him know that his cousin would very likely sit with us, and she had been always used to see the Sabbath respected. So he had as good leave his guns and bits of indoor work alone while she stayed. He coloured up at the news and cast his eyes over his hands and clothes. The train oil and gunpowder were shoved out of sight in a minute. I saw he meant to give her his company, and I guessed, by his way, he wanted to be presentable. So laughing, as I durst not laugh when the master is by, I offered to help him, if he would, and joked at his confusion. He grew sullen and began to swear. "Now, Mrs. Dean," Zillah went on, seeing me not pleased by her manner. "You happen to think your young lady too fine for Mr. Hareton, and happen you're right. But I own I should love well to bring her pride a peg lower. And what will all her learning and her daintiness do for her now? She's as poor as you or I. Poorer, I'll be bound. You're saving, and I'm doing my little all that road." Hareton allowed Zillah to give him her aid, and she flattered him into a good humour. So when Catherine came, half forgetting her former insults, he tried to make himself agreeable, by the housekeeper's account. "Missus walked in," she said, "as chill as an icicle and as high as a princess. I got up and offered her my seat in the armchair. No, she turned up her nose at my civility. Earnshaw rose too and bid her come to the settle and sit close by the fire. He was sure she was starved." "I've been starved a month and more," she answered, resting on the word as scornful as she could. And she got a chair for herself and placed it at a distance from both of us. Having sat till she was warm, she began to look round, and discovered a number of books on the dresser. She was instantly on her feet again, stretching to reach them, but they were too high up. Her cousin, after watching her endeavours a while, at last summoned courage to help her. She held her frock, and he filled it with the first that came to hand. That was a great advance for the lad. She didn't thank him. Still, he felt gratified that she had accepted his assistance, and ventured to stand behind as she examined them, and even to stoop and point out what struck his fancy in certain old pictures which they contained. Nor was he daunted by the saucy style in which she jerked the page from his finger. He contented him with going a bit further back and looking at her instead of the book. She continued reading, or seeking for something to read. His attention became, by degrees, quite centred in the study of her thick, silky curls. Her face he couldn't see, and she couldn't see him. And perhaps not quite awake to what he did, but attracted like a child to a candle, at last he proceeded from staring to touching. He put out his hand and stroked one curl, as gently as if it were a bird. He might have stuck a knife into her neck. She started round in such a taking. "Get away this moment! How dare you touch me? Why are you stopping there?" she cried in a tone of disgust. "I can't endure you. I'll go upstairs again if you come near me." Mr. Hareton recoiled, looking as foolish as he could do. He sat down in the settle very quiet, and she continued turning over her volumes another half hour. Finally, Earnshaw crossed over and whispered to me, "Will you ask her to read to us, Zillah? I'm stalled of doing nought, and I could like to hear her. Dunnot say I wanted it, but ask of you sen."
"Mr. Hareton wishes you would read to us, ma'am," I said immediately. "He'd take it very kind. He'd be much obliged."
She frowned, and looking up answered,
"Mr. Hareton, and the whole set of you, will be good enough to understand that I reject any pretence at kindness you have the hypocrisy to offer. I despise you, and will have nothing to say to any of you. When I would have given my life for one kind word, even to see one of your faces, you all kept off. But I won't complain to you. I'm driven down here by the cold, not either to amuse you or enjoy your society."
"What could I have done?" began Earnshaw. "How was I to blame?"
"Oh, "You are an exception," answered Mrs. Heathcliff. "I never missed such a concern as you."
"But I offered more than once, and asked," he said, kindling up at her pertness. "I asked Mr. Heathcliff to let me wake for you."
"Be silent. I'll go out of doors, or anywhere, rather than have your disagreeable voice in my ear," said my lady.
Hareton muttered she might go to hell for him, and unslinging his gun, restrained himself from his Sunday occupations no longer. He talked now freely enough, and she presently saw fit to retreat to her solitude. But the frost had set in, and, in spite of her pride, she was forced to condescend to our company more and more. However, I took care that there should be no further scorning at my good nature. Ever since, I've been as stiff as herself, and she has no lover or liker among us. And she does not deserve one, for let them say the least word to her, and she'll curl back without respect of anyone. She'll snap at the master himself, and as good as dares him to thrash her, and the more hurt she gets, the more venomous she grows.
At first, on hearing this account from Zillah, I determined to leave my situation, take a cottage, and get Catherine to come and live with me. But Mr. Heathcliff would as soon permit that as he would set up Hareton in an independent house, and I can see no remedy at present unless she could marry again, and that scheme it does not come within my province to arrange.
Thus ended Mrs. Dean's story. Notwithstanding the doctor's prophecy, I am rapidly recovering strength, and though it be only the second week in January, I propose getting out on horseback in a day or two, and riding over to Wuthering Heights, to inform my landlord that I shall spend the next 6 months in London. And if he likes, he may look out for another tenant to take the place after October. I would not pass another winter here for much. Chapter 31 Yesterday was bright, calm, and frosty. I went to the Heights, as I proposed. My housekeeper entreated me to bear a little note from her to her young lady, and I did not refuse, for the worthy woman was not conscious of anything odd in her request. The front door stood open, but the jealous gate was fastened, as at my last visit. I knocked and invoked Earnshaw from among the garden beds. He unchained it, and I entered. The fellow is as handsome a rustic as need be seen. I took particular notice of him this time, but then he does his best, apparently, to make the least of his advantages. I asked if Mr. Heathcliff were at home. He answered, "No, but he would be in at dinner-time." It was 11 o'clock, and I announced my intention of going in and waiting for him, at which he immediately flung down his tools and accompanied me in the office of watchdog, not as a substitute for the host. We entered together. Catherine was there, making herself useful in preparing some vegetables for the approaching meal. She looked more sulky and less spirited than when I had seen her first. She hardly raised her eyes to notice me, and continued her employment with the same disregard to common forms of politeness as before, never returning my bow and good morning by the slightest acknowledgment. She does not seem so amiable, I thought, as Mrs. Dean would persuade me to believe. She's a beauty, it is true, but not an angel. Earnshaw surlily bid her remove her things to the kitchen. "Remove them yourself," she said, pushing them from her as soon as she had done, and retiring to a stool by the window, where she began to carve figures of birds and beasts out of the turnip parings in her lap. I approached her, pretending to desire a view of the garden, and, as I fancied, adroitly dropped Mrs. Dean's note onto her knee, unnoticed by Hareton. But she asked aloud, "What is that?" and chucked it off. "A letter from your old acquaintance, the housekeeper at the Grange," I answered, annoyed at her exposing my kind deed, and fearful lest it should be imagined a missive of my own. She would gladly have gathered it up at this information, but Hareton beat her. He seized and put it in his waistcoat, saying Mr. Heathcliff should look at it first. Thereat Catherine silently turned her face from us, and very stealthily drew out her pocket-handkerchief and applied it to her eyes. And her cousin, after struggling a while to keep down his softer feelings, pulled out the letter and flung it on the floor beside her, as ungraciously as he could. Catherine caught and perused it eagerly. Then she put a few questions to me concerning the inmates, rational and irrational, of her former home, and gazing towards the hills, murmured in soliloquy, "I should like to be riding Minnie down there. I should like to be climbing up there. Oh, I'm tired. I'm stalled, Hareton." And she leant her pretty head back against the sill, with half a yawn and half a sigh, and lapsed into an aspect of abstracted sadness, neither caring nor knowing whether we remarked her. "Mrs. Heathcliff," I said, after sitting some time mute, "you are not aware that I am an acquaintance of yours, so intimate that I think it strange you won't come and speak to me. My housekeeper never wearies of talking about and praising you, and she'll be greatly disappointed if I return with no news of or from you, except that you received her letter and said nothing." She appeared to wonder at this speech, and asked, "Does Ellen like you?" "Yes, very well," I replied hesitatingly. "You must tell her," she continued, "that I would answer her letter, but I have no materials for writing, not even a book from which I might tear a leaf." "No books?" I exclaimed. "How do you contrive to live here without them, if I may take the liberty to inquire? Though provided with a large library, I'm frequently very dull at the Grange. Take my books away, and I shall be desperate." "I was always reading when I had them," said Catherine, "and Mr. Heathcliff never reads, so he took it into his head to destroy my books. I've not had a glimpse of one for weeks. Only once I searched through Joseph's stall of theology, to his great irritation, and once, Hareton, I came upon a secret stock in your room. Some Latin and Greek and some tales and poetry, all old friends. I brought the last here, and you gathered them as a magpie gathers silver spoons for the mere love of stealing. They are of no use to you, or else you concealed them in the bad spirit that, as you cannot enjoy them, nobody else shall. Perhaps your envy counseled Mr. Heathcliff to rob me of my treasures. But I have most of them written on my brain and printed in my heart, and you cannot deprive me of those.